Welcome to Vanguard Books. We're going to today do Revelo Oliver, Revelo P. Oliver's The Jewish Strategy, and we're going to do chapters 5 and 6. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this book, PDF, kevinalfredstrom.com. It's also probably other places on the internet. Find many other books at vnnforum.com, my home, also alexlinder.com. Follow me on Twitter at The Linder Files. Revelo Oliver, chapters 5 and 6. All right, chapter 5, The Jewish Strategy Itself, in their own words. The Jewish strategy itself, in their own words. So what Jews say about what they are doing. Now, Oliver says, again, this is about a 100-page book. We're right in the middle part of it right now. Do two chapters. The Jewish strategy itself in their own words, colon in their own words. The origin of the Jews as a race is unknown. The origin of the Jews as a race is unknown. But there are indications that they early began to exploit the superstitions of the populations on which they fastened themselves. The Jews have a tale that their ancestor named Abraham came from Ur in Sumeria, U-R in Sumeria, with mortgages on half the Sumerians' real estate in his pocket, (?). And some scholars, not highly regarded today, have suggested that some of the Semitic-speaking peoples with whom the Sumerians foolishly tried to coexist meddled extensively with the Sumerian religion and perhaps even had an influence on the white pre-Aryan civilization of the Indus Valley. So, it bears, keep that in mind. Oliver says that the origin of the Jews is not known. It's unknown. But they basically came to historical light as a sort of swindling tribe that uses the superstitions of the locals against themselves, much the way that Jews in 2014, as I talked to you, would use the Christian Zionists against themselves by sticking extra verses in their Bible so that the Bible, when it's taught in the seminaries where they train the preachers, basically says that, you know, good stuff about Israel or whatever the Jews want the stupid goyim to believe is inserted into the Bible, or existing verses are reworked, where they come up with annotated new verses as in the Schofield Bible. They annotate it and they interpret it so that it's always pro-Israel and anti-white. And the sapsuckers go along and are willing to join the army and die for Israel. Anyhow, the origin, we repeat as we read this, just to fix it in the mind. Not just, we don't want to just blankly read it. I know that maybe sometimes that's frustrating, but I think it's more useful. Think about what we're reading, know it, not merely lightly amuse ourselves. So the origin of the Jews as a race is unknown, but there are indications they early began to exploit the superstitions of the populations on which they fastened themselves. Notice that he's using the language you would use to describe a leech or a tick, parasitic. They fasten themselves. What fastens itself? A tick fastens itself on you. So do the Jews fasten themselves on local populations. Like they fastened themselves on America, but they were doing the same thing 2,000 years ago. As we've seen in earlier chapters, they were causing exactly the same kind of disturbances back then they do today, and demanding the same special privileges and treatment 2,000 years ago they demand today. The Jews have a tale that their ancestor named Abraham came from Ur in Sumeria. And some scholars, not highly regarded today, have suggested that some of the Semitic-speaking peoples with whom the Sumerians foolishly tried to coexist meddled extensively with the Sumerian religion. So, as they would meddle with the Bible, the Christian Bible, via Schofield, they basically paid off a goy to reinterpret the Bible and put that into general circulation in the 1850 to 1910 period. So they were doing 2,000 years ago. Their Sumerians foolishly tried to coexist with these Semitic-speaking peoples. And perhaps these Semitic-speaking peoples even had an influence on the white, pre-Aryan civilization of the Indus Valley. There is a firmer basis for conjecture, but only a conjecture, mind you, that would explain one of the oddities of the New Testament, quote-unquote, which was assembled by a Christian sect that professed a religion that was obviously a Judaized, one of the words E. Michael Jones likes to use, a Protestantism is Judaized, that is, it's influenced by Judaism, put into a sort of a Jewish vein of thinking, I guess. But he's saying there's a firmer basis for a conjecture that so the Semitic peoples may have had an influence even back before the pre-Aryan white people into the Indus Valley. You may remember from school that's one of the starts of civilization, although, of course, even that could be Semitized history or Judaized history. That explains one of the oddities of the New Testament, which was assembled by a Christian sect that professed a religion that was obviously a Judaized form of Zoroastrianism. Now, that's a religion that has a distinct, you'll see the adjective Manichaean, it's distinct. The world is divided into a good and the bad, good and evil, and the devil's over one and the angel's over the other. But anyway, everyone has noticed the curious detail in that story about the birth of the Christ named Jesus. Again, implying there's more than one Christ. Jesus is one Christ. Christ is a generic term for Messiah. There are multiple Christs. Oliver believes that Jesus, the likeliest thing is that he was a composite. Sort of like the Washington Post reporter, a black female, famously concocted a composite drug-using, crack-addicted kid who was like 8, if I recall correctly. And it was taken from bits and pieces of different stories floating around, but there was no actual kid named, I think his name was Michael or something. And Oliver has suggested, not in this book or this chapter, but in other places where he's written about the origins of Christianity, that Jesus was the Christ character was a composite myth that around which accretions of the miracle screw, rather than a historical figure who actually did what's claimed in the Bible. Maybe you know people who bring people back from the dead. I personally don't. But, you know, there are other places in the world than northeastern Missouri, so, you know, maybe there's stuff going on out there. Where you wacky people live, I don't know. Anyway, so he's saying, he's trying to figure out where did the Jews come from. Okay, well, in the Christian sect, professed a religion that was obviously a Judaized form of Zoroastrianism. Everyone has noticed the curious detail in that story about the birth of the Christ named Jesus. The birth of the Christ named Jesus, as opposed to the Christ name Jacob or John or some other name. Christ being Messiah, Messiah being leader. The birth of the Christ named Jesus, which gives the earlier date for the event. The nativity is said to have been attended by Zoroastrian priests who were said to have been guided to that spot by an obliging star or planet that floated in the atmosphere at an altitude no greater than that of the cumulus clouds to show them the way, i.e. the three wise men story. It is possible that the Magi, the professional holy men of the religion that was spread through the old Persian Empire, I think that's Zoroastrianism, were Jews. Now, looking up Magi, just so we know exactly what we're dealing with here, it means plural noun singular, magus. Magus. The wise men, generally assumed to be three in number, who paid homage to the infant Jesus, Matthew 2, chapter 2, verses 1 to 12. Those would be Balthazar, Caspar, and Melchior. Also, the second definition, sometimes lowercase for Magi, the class of Zoroastrian priests in ancient Media and Persia, reputed to possess supernatural powers. And a third definition, astrologers. So basically magicians, priests, three wise men in Christianity. But so it could either be a generic astrologers or Zoroastrian priest, or the three wise men in Christianity, magi, generally capitalized, sometimes lowercase, I believe, is what it says. And so, returning to our script, there's a firmer basis for conjecture, but only a conjecture, mind you, that would explain one of the oddities of the New Testament, which was assembled by a Christian sect that professed a religion that was obviously a Judaized form of Zoroastrianism. Everyone has noticed the curious detail that in the story about the birth of the Christ named Jesus, which gives the earlier date for the event, the nativity is said to have been attended by Zoroastrian priests, who were said to have been guided to this spot by an obliging star or planet that floated in the atmosphere at an altitude no greater than that of cumulus clouds to show them the way. So I guess he's saying those three that we named were Zoroastrian priests, were the three wise men guided to the birth of Jesus or the nativity. Of course, we're right in that time period of year. Well, although others will say that Jesus wasn't born, if he existed, he was born not on December 25th. That was taken from a pagan Roman festival. But it is possible that the professional holy men of the religion that was spread through the old Persian Empire, that is Zoroastrianism, were Jews. The Jews have a tradition, I guess Jews as opposed to Zoroastrians. The Jews have a tradition, and then he has a lot of parenthetical citation quotes. I'll just read them, but that's what I'm doing as we go through. The Jews have a tradition, parentheses, for period REG period 17.6 semicolon 1811, that there were colonies of Israelites in Media. It's a city, M-E-D-I-A. And he says in the cities, naturally, there were colonies of Israelites in Media. So that's a sort of an empire, and I guess where the Medes were, and the Jews lived in the cities there, naturally, he says. And the Magi not only claimed to come from Media, but were a closed caste racially, and like the Jews, propagated themselves through the female line, often obtaining pure offspring by impregnating their sisters or mothers. So the Jews have a tradition that there were colonies of Israelites in Media, and the Magi not only claimed to come from Media, but were a closed caste racially and propagated themselves as the Jews did through the female line. So he says, it is now virtually certain that at least the greater part of the extant holy books of the supposedly Aryan religion, although now in an odd dialect of Old Persian, were translated from a Semitic language. Diogenes Laertius, L-A-E with umlaut R-T-I-U-S, mentions in passing unnamed Greek geographers who thought that the Magi were early Jews. But since those works are now lost, we cannot say whether that opinion was based on more than the fact that after the fall of the Persian Empire, many of the Magi who peddled their cult in other lands were known to be Jews. Herodotus' description, I'm not even going to read the parenthetical sightings. If you want to look it up and read them, they're all there. Herodotus's description of the Magophonia, the Persian reaction when one of the Magi attempted a particularly outrageous fraud, sounds very much like a racial outbreak. And Howe and Wells, in their commentary on Herodotus, suggest that the Magi may have been, quote, non-Aryan, unquote. From these and a few minor traces, one can construct an hypothesis that would be highly significant if there were any real proof in it. So he's saying these Jews might have existed in the among the Zoroastrians in Media and might have been the three wise men. But he says, moving on to a new paragraph, whatever their origin, there cannot be the slightest doubt about the method that Jews have always regarded as ideal in capturing control of a country. It is set forth clearly and explicitly in the Old Testament, Genesis 47. 1-27. I'll give you the Bible sites because I know you'll have one of those around somewhere if you want to look it up. But anyway, he says, Jews have always had their way of taking over a country, and that's revealed in Genesis 47, 1-27, regardless of whatever their actual origins are, which are unknown. That's the key thing to take away. The hero of this tale in Genesis is a Jew named Joseph, who is said to have been brought to Egypt as a slave, but who cleverly wriggled upward in Egyptian society until he was in a position to prey upon the good nature and superstitions of the Egyptian king, whom he first manipulated to permit an influx of Jews who somehow take possession of the best land in the nation. Then he uses the king's authority to corner the grain market and is thus able to take from the Egyptians all their money, all their cattle, then all their land, so that he has all the Egyptians except the Egyptian priests, with whom he evidently maintains a prudent but odd alliance, at his mercy, forces the famine wretches to sell themselves into slavery, and then shrewdly transports groups of the slaves from one end of the country to the other, mixing up the population so thoroughly that all his victims find themselves among strangers with whom they would scarcely dare to concert an effective protest, and the Jews no doubt snickering in private, annexed property and multiplied exceedingly. So that's how they take over land, mixing it up racially, worming themselves into the up to the king and establishing positions and then cornering the market and just acting like complete shits, basically. And the funny thing is these gullible, goyish Christians, this is their holy book. That tells you what suckers they are. Joseph used the Egyptian king as a convenient puppet in this operation, and the tale implies, of course, that he enjoyed the cooperation of his tribe's special god, at least when he was operating as a fortune teller on his way up. It is hard to say how much fact may underlie the story, which is obviously an exposition of the Jews' ideal methods. Some kings of Europe appear to have been feeble-minded, and there is even a record that one of them admitted some desert nomads who put up a piteous plea that their pastures had dried up. But the principal feature of the tale, more probably reflect Jewish ambitions rather than actual events. However that may be, the tale certainly sketches an ideal modus operandi for subjugating the goyim, and the Jews of today will surely not have the audacity to claim that description of their methods was forged by the secret police of Russia under the czars! So, he's saying that the Jews may deny that what was revealed in the protocols reflects actual goings-on or their actual intentions and plot, but they're not, at least they're going to admit that they did write that in the Bible, and that is what they think. So, he says, the Jews claim that the so-called protocols of the elders of Zion, which were certainly published as early as 1904 and reportedly much earlier in books, that were destroyed when the Jews seized Russia in 1917, are a quote-unquote forgery, as indeed they may be, although they describe in detail and with complete accuracy the methods that the Jews have consistently used throughout this century, the 20th century, to subvert our civilization and destroy our race. But Aryans who wish to understand the Jewish mentality need not rely on that document. They have only to read the Old Testament with minds that are not immobilized in a fog of superstitious awe. As all the dopey goyim from, the Puritans to the even earlier Protestants all look in the Old Testament and try to find themselves as modern-day analogs who are out to set up a new Jerusalem, rather than noting the nastiness, the cunning, and the deceit, and the murderousness that have motivated the Jews by their own hand and their own words in the Old Testament. See, he's saying if you read this with an open mind and look at it, you'll see what a crooked people their own words convict them of being. Of course, it's not conviction of them. They think they're great stuff. But he's saying you don't need the protocols to understand what Jews are like. The Old Testament will suffice if you read it with an open mind instead of thinking that it's hallowed or sacred. So they, Mossad's motto today by way of deception fits the old time Jews. They show up as strangers claiming they're, you know, they need help, just like the Jews fleeing from Europe. Why do they need help? Because they committed swindles somewhere else and got found out and booted. Anyway, And it's also interesting to note what he says. He says the Jews claim the so-called protocols of the Elders of Zion were a forgery. And he says they may be, although they describe with complete accuracy the methods Jews have consistently used throughout this century to subvert our civilization and destroy our race. And he says the protocols were certainly published as early as 1904 and reportedly much earlier in books that were destroyed when the Jews seized Russia in 1917. And the Jews say they're a forgery, but they describe with complete accuracy, is his term, the methods Jews use in this century, 20th century. But you can, if you want to throw that aside, you can get the same information out of the Old Testament, provided you read it with a mind that is, quote, not immobilized in a fog of superstitious awe, unquote, then picking up. There is scarcely a chapter of that pseudo-historical narrative that is not highly revealing. For example, there never was a Persian king named Ahasuerus, A-H-A-S-U-E-R-U-S. There never was a Persian king named Ahasuerus, A-S-S-U-E-R-U-S. Christian holy men usually claim that the name is a mistake for Artaxerxes, A-R-T-A-X-E-R-X-E-S. So they're saying that there never was a Persian king named Ahasuerus, but Christian holy men usually claim the name is a mistake for Artaxerxes. But the fiction about Esther is an inspirational epilogue to remind Jewesses that while they may find it expedient to marry a male of the lower races, they must always remember their duty to manipulate the stupid goy to exploit him for the advantage of their master race. And there we see the use of the word apologue, which you may not be familiar with, which means a didactic narrative, a moral fable. That didactic means intended to, it refers to teaching, adjective, instructing, or second definition, an allegory, but he's using it by the first, a didactic narrative, a moral fable intended to teach a lesson. So Esther, the story about Esther, she worms her way in, like Joseph did, and using her sexual wiles, I believe, if I recall, and tricks and dupes the stupid goy king into serving her people instead of his own. And so, just to read it again, but the fiction about Esther is an inspirational apologue or moral fable to remind Jewesses that while they may find it expedient to marry a male of the lower races, they must always remember their duty to manipulate the stupid goy to exploit him for the advantage of their master race. And that actually ends chapter 5, which is about how the Jewish strategy as they see it themselves, which is just that. Inveigle themselves into the confidence of the goyish rulers and trick them and exploit them for their own race, quite parasitically, quite cold-bloodedly, using their sexual wiles or whatever it is, if they're male, to get inside. And so, moving on to chapter 6, a unique mentality. This is on page 39 of the text. A unique mentality, chapter 6. The racial mentality of the Jews is so different from our own that we can only draw inferences from observation of their conduct and such of their statements as appear more or less candid and worthy of belief. Maurice Samuel's excellent You Gentiles, italics, that's a book, New York, 1924. Maurice Samuel's excellent You Gentiles, published in 1924, but we must remember that all forms of life instinctively and necessarily make the preservation and increase of their species their highest purpose. And if vampire bats were capable of reason, they would undoubtedly describe their furtive blood-sucking as a righteous exercise and identify as diabolically evil the various animals, including men, who in one way or another interfere with their noble exercise of their God-given right to exist and propagate, that is. So, again, the racial mentality of the Jews is so different from our own that we can only draw inferences from observation of their conduct and such of their statements as appear more or less candid and worthy of belief. But he's saying, you know, remember, don't get angry about it. Look at it from a biological point of view. Parasitism is extremely common in the animal world. And each form of life has the, if you will, natural right to try to increase its own success rate and build a better environment at the cost of others. That's just how nature works. So you can get mad about it or not, but it's going to continue to be the case. And you're wise to look at it coldly and objectively. No species, says Revelo Oliver, no species could think of itself as evil. As an ex-communist once told me, you must remember that when communists betray a nation or murder innocent people by the thousands, they think of themselves as highly moral individuals who righteously obey a higher purpose. We may be absolutely certain that whatever Jews do as a race, no matter how vile and dastardly it may seem to us who suffer its effects, seems to them just and righteous. As indeed it is, if we consider it objectively, in terms of the biological law that makes survival and increase the highest law of every species. Now remember, 99% of species that ever existed are extinct. So there is competition, and even if you believe God set up the world, he infused nature with that particular principle of genocide. Genocide springing from racial competition and unceasing racial, biological, interspecies, in-species competition. Biology's highest law. Making survival and increase the highest law of every species. A great strength of the Jews is, and the bond of their racial cohesion is their religion, which, in the widest sense, is an unlimited faith in the absolute superiority of their race. For as Maurice Samuel reminds us, Jewish atheists, who deride a belief in the supernatural beings, worship the immortal Jewish people. So Jews can be atheists, but what binds them is a belief in the superiority of their race. And that's what provides their cohesiveness. That surely has to be simulated or stimulated and simulated among whites. And Nazism would be seen, I think McDonald would say, as a mirror strategy to Judaism, bringing a gun to a gunfight, that we are doing this for Germany and for our race of people, since they brought in 1 million fighters from other parts of Europe. We have to defend our race and take pride in our race and prefer our race and believe. Notice he doesn't say love. He just says belief that it's superior. You have to believe that you exist, that you're better in order to even want to compete. And somehow this tiny tribe of people worked out this idea, false or true. It may have been false at one point, but it became true at some point that they were superior to other groups, as demonstrated by the biological law. They've survived and thrived and increased and dominated other peoples. To compete with them, whites have to do the same thing. Again, the great strength of the Jews and the bond of their racial cohesion is their religion, which in the widest sense is simply an unlimited faith in the absolute superiority of their race. For as Maurice Samuel reminds us in his book, You Gentiles, in 1924, Jewish atheists who deride a belief in the supernatural beings worship the immortal Jewish people. Beyond this, we cannot be definite, for doubtless there always has been the widest gamut of personal belief, and there is every evidence of wild and grotesquely emotional fanaticism among the lower classes, as among the rabble that was stirred up by the numerous Getae and self-appointed Christ in the first century before Christ and the first century of our area, with perennial outbreaks of insane violence. And many Jewish sects have bizarre notions that must be sincerely entertained, as for example by the Polish Hasidim, who made it their male and female children as soon as possible, or as soon as they were puberate, that is, as soon as they hit puberty, to raise the birth rate to the maximum for the express purpose of exhausting God's stock of good Jewish souls as soon as possible, and thus forcing him to bring the world to an end sooner than he intended. So that sounds pretty insane, but what he's saying is their Jews themselves are riven by all these crazy beliefs, among different sects, and they fought over all this stuff, yet they were racially cohesive when it came to outsiders. Now, he used the italics word Getae, G-O-E, with a two dots over T-A-E. And I'm not precisely, let's see what that is. I don't see a definition of Getae, but it must mean some kind of, it's something religiously related. Stirred up by the numerous Getae and of self-appointed Christ, it's some kind of religious leader. We'll take it from the context. And he also had a footnote that's quite extensive that's worth reading. Now, this was on footnote 8. I'll read the sentence and then the footnote. We may be absolutely certain that whatever the Jews do as a race, no matter how vile and dastardly it may seem to us who suffer its effects, seems to them just and righteous, as indeed it is if we consider it objectively in terms of the highest of the biological law that makes survival and increase the highest law of every species. Footnote 8. And in 8 he says, the Aryans are an apparent exception since to this law of wanting their own species to thrive, since everywhere, and most conspicuously in the United States, Britain, and now South Africa, they are evidently driven by a subconscious death wish. The species may be biologically degenerate, or, as the Jews believe, inferior and innately stupid, easily herded by its credulity and cupidity, that is, its gullibility and its greed. Some optimists believe that the species could recover its will to live and become viable again if it were somehow to escape the control of its Jewish herdsmen. Before the political murder of Dr. Verwoerd, V-E-R-W-O-E-R-D, many rational Americans saw in South Africa a bright hope for our ill-starred race and regarded the Afrikaners as conspicuously intelligent and uncorrupted members of it, attributing their prudence to the fact that they were separated by only a generation from the pioneers who fought an heroic war for independence, perhaps also to some peculiar integrity in the Dutch Reformed Church, which appeared to have retained some belief in the traditional Christianity of the West at a time when the churches elsewhere had been bought and converted into mere instruments of subversion. Since the murder of Dr. Verwoerd, and I believe he was the one who set up apartheid, if I'm not mistaken, I might be, but I think he might have been the one. Since the murder of Dr. Verwoerd, I'm giving it more of a German pronunciation, which was made to seem fortuitous to persons who do not understand the rule of qui bono, that is, who benefited from his murder, it has become painfully apparent that the Afrikaners are as gullible and venal, or corrupt, as befuddled and stultified as the majority of British and Americans, that what we mistakenly attributed to a people was only the genius of one man, whose achievements remind one of Philip Payman, P-H-I-L-I-P-O-E-M-E-N, who led the Greeks in their last stand for independence, and to whose influence over his decadent and demoralized people Baudelaire paid tribute in the memorable lines of his earliest poem, Cumte mirantur ad alta se credunt genitos, and I can't tell you what that means. It's in Latin, but I'll see if I can translate it. Nope, can't translate it because it looks like there's some kind of anti-copy mechanism on this copy that I've got. So we'll just move ahead with that. Anyway, that's the footnote number 8. So he's saying that the Aryan race seems to have lost its will to survive and have a subconscious death wish, whether you believe that or not. Anyway, back to the text, Jews are full of wild, crazy subsets, sects, that believe absolutely ridiculous thing, like he's saying the Polish Hasidim, and remember, that's where the bulk of the Jewish population today comes from, Ashkenazis. Jews are about 90% Ashkenazi, 10% Sephardic, and the Ashkenazi basically come from Poland. That's where their numbers really greatly increased. I think about 1,000 to from 500 to or 1,000 to 1,500, and then they spread out over Europe after Napoleon and became Napoleon made them citizens, and they started breaking out of the ghettos. But the bulk of the population came from Poland. It's sort of the knock-kneed, pasty white scholar type, that with the earlocks. And he's saying the Polish Hasidim mated their male and, we'll just say this again because it's so outrageous, who mated their male and female children as soon as they were puberate, P-U-B-E-R-A-T-E, to raise the birth rate to the maximum for the express purpose of exhausting God's stock of good Jewish souls as soon as possible, and thus forcing him to bring the world to an end sooner than he intended. I mean, that's zany. But such vagaries among the excitable and irrational lower classes have really little significance for the racial faith. On the other hand, when one turns to the literate Jews, one cannot confidently distinguish between what they believe and what they deem expedient to profess. Fighting between various Jewish sects has often been bloody, violent, and viciously inhuman, but seems not to have been so much over doctrinal differences as over the ambitions of leaders who were ruthlessly slugging it out for power and wealth and used a religious peculiarity to recruit and excite their private armies. Sort of internal swindlers' wars among them for control. Religion maybe as a pretext. And at the limit, we have no assurance that the psychological process that we call belief and distinguish from hypocrisy and mendacity occurs in the Jewish mind, which may not distinguish between truth and falsity in terms of some objective reality, as Aryans do, even when the reality is merely a product of their imaginations. And if that seems crazy to you, like they don't even perceive reality the way we do, that they don't even make a distinction between truth and lie, just simply tune into Eric Hunt or any one of these documentaries about the Holocaust and listen to them. They're saying things that are objectively ridiculous, repeating stuff they either believe or don't believe, but picked up from some movie or book that was written about the Holocaust, so-called. And it's very easy to believe that they don't have any, the difference between truth and lie doesn't exist to them. Hence their great belief in narrative as their leftists, the leftists they've trained, say today. And you see them at the time. I could give you an example if I were reading this in 78. I could give you other examples. I'm reading it in 2014, and we've just come through seeing these rape hoaxes by Jew Sabrina Rubin Erdely down at writing in Rolling Stone about a fictitious gang rape down at UVA, University of Virginia, while they're real black on white and black on black or black on brown gang rapes going on across the country, and she makes one up about Virginia. But it's easy to believe they don't. Truth is whatever suits their purposes. They may not even have a concept for truth. It's all the same thing, whatever's good for them. And they refuse to examine their own behavior, which further lends the idea that they don't even perceive lying as a thing. It's just whatever is good for them is true and real, just as they are the superior race. That's what they have to believe, and they ignore all evidence to the contrary. And if they can carry it off long enough, then it becomes real in a sense. Truth is the loudest lie would be the parallel to that racial belief. Like, so again, at the limit, we have no assurance that the psychological process that we call belief and distinguish from hypocrisy and mendacity occurs in the Jewish mind, which may not distinguish between truth and falsity in terms of some objective reality, as Aryans do, even when the reality is merely a product of their imagination, so far as we can tell. Indeed, the racial mentality of this alien species may, by a psychological process beyond our understanding, think only in terms of what is good for the Jewish people, the divine race, and may only simulate in discourse with our species our distinction between what is objectively true and what is not, much as we train animals by teaching them lessons in terms of their mental conformation. It's quite an interesting point and bears thinking on, that they don't starting with them, their mind is a black box, and dealing only with the objective examples of their behavior, it's easy to believe. They never allow, Jews are hated because they're superior. They're never hated for anything that they do, is the charade they try to pull off. In fact, it's completely the reverse of the truth. But they never, ever yield to discussing their own behavior as the cause of the problem. We saw this when we were talking in the Donald Day book. And he urges Jews, as they're being kicked out of Europe, to study their own behavior. Do you need to question the reason you're being receiving this response is because of the way you act? Now, Jews all say, "Oh, they'll never consider that," because the whole thing falls apart. Then the baseless idea that Jews are superior to everyone else is the whole mainstay of the religion, and they can't abandon that or even call it into question. So that everything they do effectively is guaranteed. If they're the superior race, it's just like, if you think of yourself as a good man, then by definition, everything that you do is good. And if you were to call that into question, then your entire self-conception, like of a Christian who thinks he's good, like one of the moral maniacs, the sanctimonious madman, then your entire world would fall apart. So it always has to, by definition, be that you're good and the other guy is bad. So it can't ever be Jewish behavior. There can't be any room for wryness or reflection or objectivity. They just have to be right, and they may not even conceive of those at all. I think they do, myself, but he's just making a case here that maybe they think completely differently than we do, and there's no distinction made at all. Oliver says, our minds boggle when we try to understand such statements as Rabbi Solomon Goldman's, God is absorbed in the nationalism of Israel. He, God, creates the world, sick, in the Hebrew language. Dr. Joseph Kastein's, K-A-S-T-E-I-N-S, or E-I-N, it was not God who willed these people. It was this people who willed this God. Or any one of 100 comparable statements, which seem to us to be the ravings of madness, but are only typical of the Jewish mind, which, we must remember, has regularly, throughout history, outwitted our race. So, did they fake it till they made it? Fake it till you make it? They just claimed they were the best, and they believed it hard enough, and acted on it hard enough, refused to acknowledge reality hard enough until it became actually more or less real. And they did achieve dominance over the other races. And it must seem to them only confirmation that they are the chosen race. Who knows? The effect is the same, though. They are on top of us. As he says, they have outwitted us through the centuries, and we have not been able to fight them off. And that's what this educational series is about. I'm telling you this for the end of developing a white team that can take on the Jews, can understand what they're up to, and negate them, and defeat them, and eventually exterminate them. As they try to bring about our extermination, we must counter-exterminate them. We can only do that if we understand what they're up to, and then Christianity has nothing to do with it. Christianity has enfeebled our race, and as we move along in these books, we'll talk about the doctrine the Catholic Church had was taking no special notice of Jews until a Jewish convert came in and alerted them to what was in the Talmud, and then they set up a policy called Sicut Judaeus Non, which says, you don't molest the Jews, just prevent them from subverting your culture. But all that did was leave the Jewish menace alive because it refused to identify them biologically. Even after biological facts became known centuries later, it still clung to its dogma that they just need to be converted. And it doesn't really acknowledge anything other than, yeah, sometimes they try to subvert stuff and we shouldn't let them. But you don't let a lingering wild beast run around and just say, oh, well, you know, just don't subvert our culture. That they can't change what they are because it's biological. So they have to be dealt with as a public hygiene menace. See, Joseph, these are the two different views. Joseph Goebbels said Jews are a public hygiene problem, like crabs or lice or rats or cockroaches. The Catholic Church says, no, no, no. The problem is not what Jews are racially. That doesn't matter. The problem is they haven't had our special water dripped on their head, which will turn them into good people, good Christians. Now they're on the one true path, and everything about them will change. Well, what has changed is that by following that doctrine, it allowed Jews to fake convert to get inside the church while keeping their racial character, since after all, it is biology, or if it ever was just culture, it's long gone to seed, as Donald Day and Edgar Steele would say. And they subverted the church fully and apparently finally at Vatican II back in the 60s. So the church's policy is not good enough to protect the church itself from subversion. So how in the world is it going to defend something the church doesn't even value, which is whiteness or the white racial quality? We must defend our race overtly and directly, not make it subsidiary to some particular politics or some particular religion. So again, Oliver says that all these crazy things that rabbis say seem to us to be really nutty, but we must remember that they have regularly throughout history outwitted our race. It's essentially what the Jews have done is use your illusions. If you remember the title of a Guns N' Roses album, I think it was. He says, we, of course, often remark that men create God in their own image, thus stating a psychological and anthropological truth. And what we mean by that statement is that gods do not exist, but are mere figments of the imagination. And if a man of our race, having thus affirmed his atheism, were then to profess belief in the divinity and reality of a god or gods, we should rightly adjudge him insane. But it is obvious the Jewish mind sees no logic in worshiping a god it has knowingly created, in worshiping its own image in a mirror. That is insanity. We cannot honestly call it anything else in our terminology, but it is the insanity of a species that has successfully preyed on all others for millennia and is now achieving ownership of the entire earth. And I think that's probably one of the more important sentences in the entire book, because it's a whole concept. Jews created themselves as gods unto themselves and believed in their own superiority and believed it so hard and based everything they did on it and subordinated all other ethics or codes or behaviors to this belief and stirred up a cohesion that allowed them to act as a team that subsequently took over the world. Or if they don't fully succeed in taking over the world, tried to take over the world and came goddamn close. So that's what you need to understand about Jews. They operate as a team. They believe in themselves. They worship themselves, even though they're mostly atheists. They worship their racial collective. And they draw immense strength and cohesiveness from that. And they use it as a base for overthrowing all other countries and races and people and destroying them after they take over power from them by the means we talked about earlier. Now, there's a ninth footnote here. And it came at the end of our distinction between what is objectively true and what is not. Much as we train animals, he's saying that, so it goes to the question of whether Jews perceive objective reality and know that they're lying or essentially don't have any difference between whether narrative is the real thing to them. They don't believe in objective truth. They just believe in competing narratives. And that's not just brazen effrontery, but that's actually, they don't make a distinction. They don't recognize there any objective truth. So in footnote 90 says, or superstitious human beings. Ivor Benson gave an example when he wrote, well, let me read it so that makes more sense when you come into it. Now, this is a long sentence, but I'll read it and then I'll go into the. And at the limit, we have no assurance that the psychological process that we call belief and distinguish from hypocrisy and mendacity, i.e. lying or faking, occurs in the Jewish mind, which may not distinguish between truth and falsity in terms of some objective reality, as Aryans do, even when the reality is merely a product of their imagination, so far as we can tell. So far as we can tell, indeed, the racial mentality of this alien species may, by a psychological process beyond our understanding, think only in terms of what is good for the Jewish people, the divine race, and may only simulate in discourse with our species our distinction between what is objectively true and what is not, much as we train animals by teaching them lessons in terms of their mental conformation. Footnote 9. Or superstitious human beings. Ivor Benson gave an example when he wrote, quote, in North Africa during the last World War, one of our tasks was to teach raw Negroes from the jungle to drive 3-ton trucks. Problem number one was how to explain the gears. Common sense produced the answer. Engaging the first gear, the recruits were told, harnessed the spirit of the elephant. Slow, but very strong, just the sort of power needed to pull a truck up a steep hill or out of the mud. The second gear meant the spirit of the horse, a power faster but not as strong as that of the elephant. And moving into top gear was the speed of the antelope, which was harnessed very fast but not much use in heavy going. Now, insofar as this mythology worked with these blacks, it can be said to have been true, or at any rate to have an element of the truth, which could not be conveyed to these primitive minds in any other way. So far as religious myths are concerned, we are, of course, all in the condition of these African savages. And that was all a quote from Ivor Benson. All right, so Jews. All right, so Oliver says, if we are to be both fair and objective, we must bear in mind the difference, perhaps an enormous difference, between the Jewish mentality and our own. And that's footnote 10, which I'll read now. There could be no doubt in the footnote, I think, but that Jews perceive the physical world about it quite differently from our perception of it. Since Jews communicate with our race in Indo-European languages, and in the West even use those languages to communicate with each other, although probably attaching different meanings to many key words, or distort Indo-European languages into special dialects of their own, such as their variety of the Greek koine, K-O-I-N-E, in antiquity and Ladino, L-A-D-I-N-O, and Yiddish in more recent times, the vast psychological difference may be most clearly seen when one examines Hebrew, a dialect they form from Western Semitic, Phoenician, and impressed with their own mentality since it has many peculiarities not found in other Semitic languages. And remember that Oliver knows like 17 languages. These are set forth by Dr. Thorleif Bowman, T-O-R-L-E-I-F, or Thorleif Bowman, in his Hebrew Thought Compared with Greek, Philadelphia, Westminster Press, 1960. So, you examine Hebrew to see a better example, a truer picture of the Jewish mentality at work than you get in their dialects or Western languages they use, Indo-European. Okay. So he says, these are set forth by Dr. Thorleif or Leif Bowman in his Hebrew Thought Compared with Greek, 1960, a work that deserves the most careful study by Aryans. Dr. Bowman is a Christian and thus obligated himself to find a quote-unquote moral value in the radically different Jewish mentality, and a comparable study by an unprejudiced philologist, student of language, as a philologist is a... Oliver himself is a philologist, is greatly to be desired. So he's saying the Christian is studying this Jewish mentality in Hebrew, but he's studying it from a prejudiced, biased Christian perspective so that he has to find the Jews as good or moral when it's, if you were unprejudiced, you might find rather something else, is what Oliver is saying. Dr. Bowman is a Christian and thus obligated himself to find a moral value in the radically different Jewish mentality. Radically different Jewish mentality. And a comparable study by an unprejudiced philologist is greatly to be desired. It is entirely possible that the schizophrenic daubs, D-A-U-B-S, that are peddled to the boobs as quote-unquote modern art actually correspond to the Jewish perception of reality and instinctive hatred of what seems beautiful and noble to us, and should not therefore be regarded as merely a means of corrupting our culture and displaying contempt for us. That's debatable. I don't believe it, actually, but I suppose it deserves consideration since he thinks it does. I believe it's deliberately, it's just a like fashion almost. It's a deliberate way of getting two goals at once, like pornography, that once they can make money, but they can also degrade Christian morals. So it is with, they can outrage the bourgeois and they can make money since they, if you read books about art, you find, oh, that the art world is completely dominated by Jews. They own most of the galleries, certainly most of the main galleries. They're the curators of a lot of the museums, so they set up their own exhibits because, after all, the use of history is to make up lies and bogus narratives to mislead the goyim and to make money doing it in the art world, so they can flush stuff in and out of fashion because that's all based out of New York pretty much. And it's just another means to profit politically and commercially. I don't think they actually find a lot of that stuff beautiful. But you know, I suppose it deserves consideration. Anyway, with that, we end chapter 6. We're up to through page 43, and then we'll... we actually got one done within an hour, so... We will hopefully finish this book in the coming week. We're recording this on Saturday morning, and on, just to give a time of place, 12/20/2014. And so we'll be back with this later. I want to thank you for listening to me. I'm Alex Linder. I'm reading you Revelo P. Oliver's The Jewish Strategy, which you can find published by from Kevin Alfred Strom. If you want to read the whole book, it's on PDF there. And if you want to read a lot of other books in PDF form that we have cataloged for you in a massive database, along with much other good stuff, go to vnnforum.com. That's my home. And thanks for listening today. I'll be back with you again shortly.